the Breach, your deep dive into authoritarianism and corruption in the era of Trump. If you're enjoying the show, please take a moment to rate and review us on iTunes to help new people learn about these critical issues. Consider it an act of resistance. I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein, and my guest today is Pamela Merritt. She's a board member of NARAL Missouri and a member of the St. Louis Reproductive Justice Table. Recently, Ben Ray Lujan of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee stressed in an interview that the DCCC has no abortion litmus test. Officially, the DCCC is a piggy bank that doesn't have a litmus test on anything, which raises the question, why is he going out of his way to stress that there's no litmus test on abortion specifically? Is it a dog whistle? Is he sending a message that the Democratic leadership is willing to compromise on choice in the hopes of eking out a few more seats in the midterm elections? Bernie Sanders brought this issue to a head when he campaigned for anti-choice Democrat Heath Mello for mayor of Omaha. Sanders said that Democrats should do their best to fight for a pro-choice agenda, but that you can't just exclude people who disagree with us on one issue. Is that really the right way to be looking at it, though? Are there really these hordes of would-be Democrats who came for the fight for 15 but won't stay for the fight for reproductive freedom? Is the Democratic Party wise to cater to these hypothetical supporters at the expense of its most loyal actual supporters, notably women of color? Pamela, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Representative Benjamin Ray Lujan, in an interview with The Hill, reaffirmed that the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee has no litmus test for abortion, sparking a great deal of controversy. Why were people so upset about that?
Oh gosh, there are so many reasons. I think the number one reason why I can speak for myself, why I was upset about that, and why I think fellow reproductive justice activists were upset, is that you simply cannot be progressive and not understand and have a fundamental understanding of how critical reproductive health care and access to the full spectrum of reproductive health care, including abortion, is to almost every plank of progressive policy. So you can't have economic justice without having reproductive justice. And this idea that we can somehow get rid of abortion or not stand in full support of abortion, it makes no sense. The other thing that I found disturbing was that this kind of came out of left field. It's not as if that was the driving issue in 2016. And in many of the areas, I live in Missouri, which is red state America. It's still not, even though it is an obsession of the state legislature, it's not necessarily what's moving people at the polls. And I have not seen any justification, nor could there be any justification for that, that isn't based in a fundamental misunderstanding of what people want to see out of progressive politics.
Does the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee have litmus tests in general? I mean, what seemed bizarre to me is that they've funded all kinds of non-progressive Democrats. I mean, you don't have to support Black Lives Matter. You don't have to support the fight for 15. You don't have to even be a Democrat if you look back far enough to when they supported Bernie over challengers when he was a congressman. Mm-hmm. Do they have any standards at all?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I want to be clear that I think that the National Party has its core group of litmus tests, and then each state party kind of gets to drive their own list of non-negotiables. So I sincerely doubt that you're going to see the National Democratic Party support somebody who questions Social Security, who questions Medicaid or Medicare, who just absolutely fundamentally doesn't agree with desegregation. You know? Yeah. I think that there's obviously some
low bar, but it's there somewhere.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And it's becoming increasingly clear that even in some of the more conservative states, Democratic parties are not supporting candidates who are overtly opposed to LGBTQ rights. I think when we get into dangerous territory is when we try to tailor a party's core platform based upon the most, you know, far out, far reaching potential cultivation in some mythological voter that we want to appeal to in every way, shape, or form. The simple reality is that we have to have a coalition of elected officials who are willing to fight for and have an understanding of some basic core realities. So I've noticed that there's this movement to kind of get all of the various state parties and the national party behind a very aggressive and progressive economic platform. And I think that that is obviously driven by the 2016 primary battle with Bernie Sanders. But I find it absolutely bizarre that they are trying to make the case that you can be progressive and have any kind of economic justice platform when you are denying people the ability to plan their families.
I'm seeing people say things like they're done with the Democratic Party because of what Lujan said in this interview. I find myself kind of perplexed that they're taking this fight, that they're taking it so strongly when it's just the DCCC. I mean, it's not the National Democratic Party. It's not being written into the platform. Why are people taking it so hard about this one sort of offhand comment in an interview?
I think a lot of people, and again, I can speak for myself as a Missourian who has watched the Missouri Democratic Party embrace candidates who are opposed to abortion. I've watched the state party embrace candidates like former state rep Jeff Rorta, who is the St. Louis Police Officers Union spokesperson and said so many horrible, racist, divisive things, and they threw their weight behind him. You know, that kind of reaction is not coming without, you know, the parties having earned it a little bit. I'm not quite 100% there with them, but I do get the fact that there's activity that happens at the state level that is not necessarily consistent with the national level. And a lot of people are holding the whole Democratic brand accountable for that.
Do you think that's a positive thing that people are getting energized about this?
I absolutely do. And it, as frustrating as it is, and there's a part of me, my initial reaction was, I cannot believe we're having this debate right now. And then I very quickly pivoted to, if this misunderstanding, be it deliberate or unintentional, is really out there, then we better have it now, because we are in the fight of my lifetime. And particularly in states like Missouri, where you have one abortion provider, you have a 72-hour mandatory waiting period with no exemptions. We have seen wave after wave after wave of fight. And to even float the idea that we are going to ask women and people who experience pregnancy to support with their vote or their money, people who are going to perpetuate the drama, is ridiculous. So I think we need to have these debates, because otherwise, I think it's a mistake, even in this resistance, it's a mistake to operate from a position that doesn't acknowledge that the people still have the power, that an overwhelming majority in Missouri and elsewhere across the country support access to abortion. So this is not some desperate debate. This is really something that we need to make the case for, or we need to make it very clear that we shouldn't be taken for granted.
Fair enough. Lujan's point was that, you know, this is going to be a huge national fight to try and retake Congress in the midterms. And he's saying, well, you know, it's not that we're trying to go out and recruit anti-choice candidates. It's just, suppose we got somebody who could only win in a Democratic district being lukewarm or hostile to choice. Is that something that's actually going to happen in the kinds of races that the DCC is interested in intervening on?
It's interesting. You know, I'm sure that they've run some numbers and they feel that it can, but I have a background in data, but it's dated. So the last time I looked at election math, it was pretty simple, which is you have to hold your base and build on it. So you're trying to get that 50 plus one, you're trying to get that little bit over index, and particularly in districts that haven't been leaning towards your party, then you really want to, you know, make sure you hold that base and build on it. I don't see how that works. I think that's assuming a level of desperation and predictability out of pro-abortion, pro-choice voters that is rather familiar to me as a Black woman. So it's insulting. I think it's dangerous. It's basically taking advantage of the desperation that we're all facing and asking women again to make a sacrifice that we would never ask of other groups with the consistency and the flippancy with which it gets asked of women. So I haven't seen them make the case on numbers any more than I've seen them make the case that abortion was the driving issue in the polls. I think the Democratic Party had a lot of messaging problems in 2016. Abortion rights probably wasn't top of mind. I just don't believe that in the districts where they are trying to make a play, that if they come in with an unapologetic, full-throated, progressive message, I think they win. I just think they haven't come in with a full-throated progressive message on multiple issues, and that's why we haven't been successful.
On the issue of retaining your base, are you saying that their calculus is wrong, that they're just focused on the votes that they could conceivably get by running an anti-choice candidate, and they're not thinking about all the votes that they could lose by slapping their base in the face?
That's what my gut is telling me, unless I'm misinterpreting the math. In order for them to achieve these flips, they have to hold their base. And what is insulting about it is it assumes that the base doesn't come to the Democratic Party with very clear needs. And particularly when we look at some of the communities that have been very loyal Democratic voters. You know, I'm a Black woman. We are the foundation of the Democratic Party when it comes to consistency in voting. Not only have I not seen news articles of the new Democratic Party leadership meeting with Black women voters or organizations that represent Black women, but I haven't heard them talk about how they are going to make sure that they answer the key critical issues that matter to us. I have heard a lot of people talk about how identity politics are the problem. And again, it's dumbfounding that policies that result in a 96% loyalty from Black women are not a problem. They're actually a really good thing because they ensure that we go to the polls and we vote consistently and with enthusiasm. When we start backing away from those policies, then it's basically saying, well, where are you going to go? And that's a dangerous question to ask.
What else politically has the Black female constituency wanted and not gotten from the Democratic Party besides reproductive rights stuff?
Absolutely. Yeah, I definitely think that, speaking for myself and my friends and my family, we're concerned deeply about the fact that the Democratic Party has spent a lot of time talking about how they're open to running anti-choice candidates. They haven't spent a lot of time talking about voter suppression. And mm-hmm. So basically, when you look at a state like Wisconsin, where Trump was able to do successfully in Wisconsin, but the voter suppression rate was some 200,000 voters, and significantly higher than the percent of voters or the actual raw numbers of voters that he was able to win by. You know, we're fighting for rights that were guaranteed to us as recently as the 60s. And to act as if that's not a key answer to some of the number problems that they experience. When you look at the states where you saw a significant drop off in Black voter turnout, you also saw a significant upturn in aggressive voter suppression.
Would that include states like North Carolina?
I think North Carolina, it was murky. It was super confusing. And that's the goal of voter suppression, to create this idea that by the time you get to Election Day, you're not quite sure if you should show up or not. And I think added to that, in 2016, there was a very concerted effort by Trump supporters to create the idea that there would be independent militia monitoring at the polls. So there's a lot of fear associated with voting, both the fear of being turned away, of being embarrassed and humiliated in a public space, of having your personal business put out there, of uncertainty. So I definitely think that as a whole, you know, Black women voters are incredibly passionate about the vote. We know that it was won in with blood, sweat, and tears, and we feel very, you know, loyal to that legacy and recognizing that legacy. But at the same time, I find it very interesting and very disappointing that the Democratic Party is doing interviews in the Hill about how they're entertaining ideas to flip these districts with anti-abortion candidates, but they haven't even set up a meeting to talk to Black women voters about some of our voter suppression concerns, about some of our state violence concerns, about the fact that we have all of these anti-abortion bills that are floating out that overwhelmingly hurt poor people and people of color. You know, infant and maternal mortality is a major concern and issue here in the middle of the country and in the upper South. And you know, the list goes on and on. Education, you know, they have a body, a population that has been incredibly loyal to them and is motivated to vote because of the concerns of our families and our communities. And, you know, if we're going to entertain different ways to increase voter turnout and make a play in places where we don't usually do so, as somebody who lives in Missouri, I can assure you that access to public education is as big a concern in rural Missouri as it is in the city.
Do you think that there might be seats to be picked up by the Democrats being more aggressive about recruiting Black female candidates to energize some of the party's most energetic and loyal supporters?
Absolutely. If I could throw confetti right now, I would throw confetti. Absolutely. When you look at the enthusiasm and excitement that is swirling around in Georgia over the governor's race, that's huge. It's a big deal. And then let's just keep it real. You know, the rise of Trump is very much so a response to the changing dynamic of America, that we are a country that is once again becoming more diverse, for lack of a better word, more Black and brown people in places where we didn't usually see significant populations. And so we need to have a party that respects that and understands that for a lot of the messages or policies that we traditionally associate with the Democratic Party matter to working class white men, they matter to working class Black women, they matter to people who live in the country, and they matter to people who live in the city.
Do you think that the DCCC was trying to send a message about this kind of rejection of quote unquote identity politics?
I do think so. And I think, you know, it's not that article in The Hill was not the first foray into this that we've seen since November of 2016. We've seen things in Omaha. This came up. We saw a vigorous race in Virginia for the primary for that state's governor's race, where it was obvious that folks were trying to say that abortion shouldn't be a primary issue of concern. So the reaction that my fellow reproductive justice activists and I are having is not based on, you know, a knee jerk. It's basically that this is something that we've heard a lot. Mm-hmm. And in Missouri, I've moved back home to Missouri in 2003, and I have seen Democrats run, anti-abortion Democrats, and I have heard this theme that the only way to play in certain areas is with a more moderate to conservative candidate since I moved back, and it has not worked. It has not been rewarded at the polls. And every single election that we do this is a missed opportunity to message to that district about why they should support progressive values.
What's that fight been like from within the platform committee of a state level Democratic Party? Can you just tell some of your experience there?
Yeah, I'd love to. So I'm a new member of the platform committee, and we've just begun our work. It's fascinating because it's a rare opportunity for the platform committee members to go out across the state of Missouri and meet with local community organizations and Democrats all over the state. And we are surveying everywhere. I mean, I've been to parts of Missouri as somebody who grew up here I'd never been to before. But we're really seeking information and input from the electorate as to what they think are important issues and how they would define those issues. And it's not necessarily a judgment of where the party has been so much as it is a weighing in on where they think the party needs to be going forward. And I will say that we haven't convened to really duke it out yet, for lack, but the feedback that I've experienced is that people are not challenging about abortion as something that it needs to be dropped. People are deeply concerned about the lack of access to healthcare in Missouri, about the fact that hospitals are closing down. They are incredibly worried about their ability to maintain their communities and their quality of life with the lack of jobs, with the lack of well-paying jobs. We hear a lot about what families struggle with, and we're not hearing that they're struggling with abortion as a platform issue. We have heard from people that they really want the party to continue to support abortion rights, but also that they feel that this battle, this fight, is something that is being used to not as an excuse to not focus on these other issues. They're not saying that as if we need to drop abortion. What they're saying is that they're frustrated with politicians in Jefferson City and the governor for constantly wasting valuable time on an issue that they feel is settled. But 201, when I hear Missourians talk about what they're worried about education, access to health care, being bankrupted by breaking their leg, and jobs.
So you're not meeting a lot of these Will Salatin-style would-be Democrats who are like, I like your message of economic justice, but I'm super pro-life. Can you just ditch the abortion?
Not in my experience. And I'm not hearing about that in online debates I'm having with Missourians either. I definitely think there's some rigorous debates about how best we move forward on a robust economic plan. But I definitely haven't heard anybody weigh in on that, with the exception of somebody who I met in rural Missouri who kind of gave me that spiel and then very quickly pivoted to acknowledge that they had never voted for a Democrat in their life.
What do you think the underlying fight is here? It seems like there's, within the Democratic Party, there are people who are talking the language of electoral expediency to want to squelch choice. Do you think that they're really motivated by electoral expediency, or do you think that there's actually an anti-choice sentiment within the Democratic Party that we need to drag out in the open?
It's a great question. I think my gut says, and I might be being generous, but my gut says that they are motivated by electoral expediency, and that their swiftness in the casual nature in which they are rejecting abortion access as an important issue is more of a symptom of a fundamental misunderstanding of what access to reproductive health care means. And I think for a lot of people, we are very well versed in how the right rejects abortion as an issue. We know how they frame it. On the left, we have people who might actually have a religious objection that they think they can weigh in personally. But a lot of folks are just like, well, it's not that big a deal. And
often folks without uteruses seem to think that.
Yeah. It's curious how that goes hand in hand. But they're not thinking that it's a big deal. And I actually had the opportunity to sit down with one of these folks who clearly was somebody who was energized by Bernie Sanders' political message, wanted to sit down and discuss some things I had said on Facebook about abortion and the importance of abortion rights, and really was asking me to explain why you can't have economic justice without having reproductive justice. I had a good 2-hour chat with this dude, and it was really fascinating how the various angles that he had not thought through. Mm-hmm. And I think we've been on the defensive, trying to defend the status quo with abortion access. And I've got my issues with that. But I think we've been on the defensive so long that we need to, shake it off a little bit and remind the left that there's a reason why abortion is an absolutely necessary litmus test to a progressive plank.
What kind of ideas were most sort of eye-opening for him when you explained to him about the links between reproductive and economic justice?
I think the way I explained it to him was just through an imagination of how women experience the world. And that when you look at states that do not have that, you know, we have abortion deserts. The state of Missouri has one provider. So, you know, multiple states are seeking access through our one provider. And when you look at the impact that that has in communities, and then you really can kind of break down exactly why, you know, a robust economic plan isn't going to work for a woman who is not able to plan her family, who's not able to access the full range of options to do so. Many of these anti-abortion candidates believe that birth control is abortion. They're against emergency contraception. They don't believe in vitro fertilization. You know, that it's not just wrapped up into abortion, and that's not to discount how important abortion is. But when they're shutting down reproductive health care providers, they're shutting down women's ability to participate in economic prosperity. And when I explained to him that in the state of Missouri, you are not going to succeed with any economic proposal if you do not support women, support women-led homes, and give them the support and stability they need to actually participate in the programs that you're dreaming up, he really started to get it. He was just like, oh, wait, you know, this is a big deal.
What does supporting women-led homes look like in practice?
Gosh, that's a great question. I think definitely, the things that come to mind are, you know, supporting our need for paid leave and understanding the radical impact that would have on so many women-led homes. When I think about raising the minimum wage for low-wage fast food workers, in the people I know and the friends I have who are trying to live on $7 and some change an hour, their lives would radically change. They would not have to work three jobs and miss out on their children's lives. They would be able to participate in their schooling in a more robust and deliberate way. You know, universal health care would...
Just to be able to parent the kids you have the way that you would want to is such a big issue in reproductive justice, I think.
It is.
It shows how it all fits together.
Yeah, it's huge. And if you're privileged enough to experience that, then, you know, all too often people who have that privilege are segregated from experiencing folks who don't. And, you know, I'm lucky enough to live in a city, in a neighborhood where I am, you know, knee deep in the working class. But, you know, my friends are struggling to afford transportation. We have a diaper charity because people can't afford diapers for their children. And the vast majority of these people are working harder than I do. They're working three jobs and they simply cannot afford rent and food and transportation. And
that's what I call deplorable, that people can be working more than full time and not be able to provide diapers for their children.
Exactly. Exactly. And so that's one of those issues that transcends across rural to city. So if you go outstate Missouri, you've got the same dynamic. You've got people who are struggling, who are working, a lot of woman-led homes that simply can't make ends meet. So we need to, you know, maybe if we started listening to, you know, what women-led homes and what Black women who are, primarily lead our homes need and build policies that support that, we might be able to actually appeal to both people who live in cities, but also people who live in more rural areas.
And that's supposedly what all this sort of economic rationalism is supposed to be aiming at anyway, is bridging those gaps. Mm-hmm. And they say drop abortion because it's divisive, but really it's the flip side that works just as well. Embrace abortion because it unites our most enthusiastic and loyal base.
Exactly. Exactly. And I struggle to understand how folks can think that they're bridging those gaps when the only considerations that they're willing to make changes for are white, straight men.
Pamela, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And now it's time for recommended reading, a hand-picked selection to deepen your understanding of the current political moment. It's by Michael Lewis in Vanity Fair, and it's called Why the Scariest Nuclear Threat May Be Coming from Inside the White House. It's the story of the Department of Energy under Donald Trump. DOE not only takes care of America's nuclear arsenal, it's responsible for scouring loose nuclear material from all over the world and monitoring to make sure that countries like Iran don't surprise us with bombs. DOE is now headed by Rick Perry, who once thought the department should be eliminated and later admitted in his confirmation hearing that he didn't understand what it did, having confused its portfolio with that of the Department of the Interior. Now the White House wants to slash DOE's budget, a decision that could have disastrous consequences not only for the U.S., but for the entire world. That's it for recommended reading. The Breach is produced by Nora Hurley for Rewire Radio. Our executive producer is Mark Folletti. Our theme music is Dark Alliance, performed by Darcy James Argue's Secret Society. And I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein. Tweet your suggestions, comments, and questions to @Beierstein, Beyerstein, on Twitter. See you next week!